This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
When I successfully focus on my breath, and there's a tiny fraction of my meditation usually is where I'm able to do that, a lot of it I'm turning to the future and to the past, a lot of that. But before we did this meditation, you talked about sort of about what pain we might have or whatever, and one of the things we're trying to do is to not run away from that, but try to find, sort of see it, I guess maybe would be a way to put it. When I do focus on my breath, my emotional state is something that I seem to be less in touch with it because I'm focusing my breath. And so I feel like I'm present in that, but a lot of times I don't sense exactly what's going on with me, especially emotionally, physically maybe more, and even intellectually more, but emotionally, it's hard for me to feel if I'm focusing on I'm successfully sort of doing the breath.
Great, yeah. A lot of what we learn in breath meditation comes from staying on the breath, but even more of what we learn comes from not staying on the breath and seeing what becomes so compelling that it seduces us away from our object of meditation. And so you're right. Your question is highlights your understanding of the technique that if we're singularly focused on the breath, that's all there is. And as concentration deepens and deepens, it's literally as if nothing else exists in this world. And so the people are forgotten, the world is forgotten, the rest of your body is forgotten, and it's just this breath, and not even this breath, not even this in-breath, it's just this fraction of the breath. And that's it. That's all that's present. Now, that's a healthy thing to cultivate, but it's a very exclusive, singular focus. We learn a lot when we see what pulls us off the breath and what kinds of emotional dramas are most sticky and compelling for us. What storylines are the hardest to let go of, right? I mean, we probably have that experience of some thoughts we recognize we're lost in thought, and it's easy to let go of some thoughts, but some thoughts are kind of like, we really want to finish the loop, you know what I mean, right? It's like I there's something good at the end of this loop, you know? And seeing that is helpful, really helpful. So you're practicing, I think, in a skillful way, and it will also do things as you practice more and more, opening the attention to include more and more. But the breath meditation is often helpful to begin to stabilize the attention, because as we open to more and more, to the body, to thinking, to sound, to sight, there's more and more chance for the attention to get, to sort of be like a ping pong ball, moving from one sense door to another, without a real sustained samadhi, sustained focus on something. And that's one of the risks of mindfulness practice, I think, is that we can sort of have the intention of opening to all that's happening, but because there's so much happening, even when things are pretty cool, right? Just sitting here, there's so much happening that the attention can kind of go from sight to getting caught in a thought to feeling a sensation in the body to hearing a sound, and it never actually fully stabilizes. So the mindfulness practice really requires a good deal of concentration, and that's often why we begin with mindfulness of breathing. Yeah.
Well, just to add to that, because I've always had a similar experience where I've really concentrated on my breathing and haven't really felt a lot. But today, one thing you said made me feel more was what's in your heart that your mind won't let in. And then that really triggered me to just kind of let go a lot more than I ever had before.
Yeah. Great. Yes, and that letting go was kind of a relax.
I didn't stop thinking about breathing. I was just kind of breathing.
Yeah.
I just was kind of lost in the moment. Just felt really good. I don't know.
Yeah.
I had like a real peaceful, positive feeling in my heart. I could feel it.
Yeah, great. Beautiful. Others.
Yeah. So at the end of a sit, often the pain starts to intensify, and I noticed that you were trying to, like, your words were really calm towards the end, and kind of like trying to focus back. But inside my body, I was just like, oh my god, I got to. How do you, when you're doing your own sit, how do you kind of, when you're it gets so intense like that, how do you bring yourself back to a calmer place? You were doing for us.
Yeah. It can get to be like an orchestra, you know, like when the body's really uncomfortable. And the orchestra is overwhelming because everybody's like playing at the same time, right? But the Buddha's advice is to untangle the strands of experience. So what is meant by that? That in that orchestra, you know, they're a band. We don't have like a bass and a guitar and drums, right? What we have is thought, body sensations, like the pain itself, and emotional reactions to it. And when that band is playing together, there's pain in the body, there's emotional reactivity, often felt like along this axis, in the face or chest or belly. And there's thinking going on. The voice is loud. Maybe we're having images of the pain. When everybody's playing together, when the bass is coming in and the two guitars and right and the drums, so you know, it's like it's all on. That's overwhelming, right? But we can actually learn to pay attention to each instrument, right? I can't do that because I have a bad musical ear. But meditation, I can't even tell what the bass is. But meditation, I'm able to untangle the sensations in my body from the emotional feelings in the body, from thoughts. And when you can begin to get clear, like, okay, my knee feels like this, you get a real clear sense of what that is. You get a real clear sense of the desperation in the chest, right? The storyline in the head, which is saying, this has got to end. Like, this has just got to stop, right? Maybe I'm cursing me out, cursing your body out, God, whoever, you know, but somebody's going to be taking a beating, right, in the head. And this all kind of tangles together and leads to the sense of the urgency to do something. And this urgency shapes our life. It literally, like, molds our life into what it is. Because it's not just pain that we're dealing with in meditating. We're dealing with discomfort of one kind or another all the time. You know? Just all the time. And that can either propel us into compulsive actions to make things more bearable, or we can soften to it. And as you practice, experiment with trying to get clearer on all the band members, and allow them, that there's actually a kind of composure of the heart that can exist even within that. And this may reduce the sense of overwhelm and experiment. Don't hurt your body. I actually hurt myself meditating. That's really stupid. Like, almost unprecedentedly stupid. You can't do it in half an hour, but you can do it in a few hours, you know, so. Don't harm the body, but usually there's a sense of like, my leg is breaking, and then you get up and like 2 seconds later you're like, oh, that's fine, let's go, right? It's just the sense of unbearableness in that moment. Sure. Yeah.
I had an experience tonight that actually kind of relates to what he was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the rain, in my apartment complex, it's bringing a lot of ants into my house.
Mm.
I think I brought an ant with me.
Oh.
And as I was meditating, kind of jamming around, you know, and concentrating on the breath and not paying attention, when I actually made it a much deeper experience.
Not paying attention, letting go of the ant? Yeah, that's interesting. That's advanced Vipassana practice. The ant? Serious. Next step? Mosquitoes.
Yeah, like you said, if you pay attention to each individual band member, it actually benefits you.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. You know, yeah, it's great. Thank you. Yeah.
How do you, like, in terms of, I have that type of personality where, like, in the beginning, when you said, all right, it's time to meditate through it.
Yeah.
And I kind of go get it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And there is even times when I'm sitting there, it's like, it seems like it's kind of like a marathon.
Mm.
I can keep going. How do you, like, you know, there's really no goal involved, obviously. You're trying, you know, just to be with whatever it is. But how do you get to that point of ease where it's like, I guess with the thing is, like, sometimes I struggle with authenticity. Like, am I doing it right? Am I not? What is it? What is it? You know, so, sometimes you're sleeping and you're like, well, I'm sorry. And then your mind is going back to the breath and it dissolves and it's fine. But, you know, like, sometimes that comes up, you know.
Yeah.
Or your back, okay, my back's hurting, you know, or go back to the breath. Is it okay to straighten out? Or do you just, you know what I mean? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, when you said authenticity, I also felt like there was a flavor of self-doubt in it, you know? And maybe that's right and maybe not, but there, you know, sometimes what happens is the mind wants to be doing or getting something the whole time we're meditating. You know? Like, my mind wants to be having insights moment after moment. So I'll pay attention to a breath, and then I'm like, what I just learned. And then another breath, and I'm just like, and now? Am I deeper? Am I right? And it's so hard to just entrust our practice to the intentions that we have. And this practice does itself. We think we're doing it. We think it's like me and my kind of like, you know, kind of dharma muscles, like, you know, bringing me into deeper peace. It's actually we're just letting go and allowing the logic of the dharma to unfold. And so what does that mean, the logic of the dharma? That there is something that happens when we pay attention. And it doesn't happen because we want it to. And it doesn't happen because we're doing something special. It's more like it happens because we're doing less. We're doing less to the moment. We're trying to squeeze less from life. And we're simply allowing the Dharma path to unfold for us, you know? And so when you sense some of that doubt coming up of, am I doing it right? Am I getting something from this? You can actually just know that as doubt. You can actually just know that as like, oh, this is doubt. And it's counterintuitive that it works this way, because it feels like we have to muscle our way to freedom, you know? But it's, in my experience, it's doing less and less. You know, Shanti Deva said, we're not here to change the world, we're here to be changed by it. The world will soften us, we just relax. Is that helpful?
Oh, yeah,
definitely. Okay. Sure. Give me one more. Eileen?
Just kind of a comment and a question together. For a long time, the different Dharma talks to the teachers talk about insights. These are, you know, insights will happen, or insights. And a lot, what are these insights? What are these people talking about? And in a way, I still don't know. So there's a, you know, I sit and sometimes I think I learned something, but a lot of the time I don't. Or sometimes I think I learned something that isn't something that can be put into words, really.
Yeah.
It's like my muscles are learning a new way of being, or my body is, but what are these, like a definition of an insight, or what's being talked about here?
Yeah.
In the Vipassana and insight, I guess, is the question, really.
Yeah. That's great. Insight, that word, is a metaphor in some ways, meaning that we call the path of progress and more freedom the path of insight. But it seems to me like we as a species don't really know how and why this practice works. I think it does. I think it does. But I don't think we really know why, or what the mechanisms of change are. It may be that what we call insight is really just the brain changing in ways that lead to more well-being. You know? that we're doing something. In the same way we might train our body, we're doing something to train our brain in a way that leads to more freedom. And we call it insight, but what's really happening is our brain is basically getting fit. That's possible. And that's one way of thinking about your question. Now, on the other hand, there are a few very core insights that we can develop. And we develop at deeper and deeper levels. So sometimes people hear the Four Noble Truths, right? Like, there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path leading to the end of suffering. And we've heard that a lot, and we're kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah. I got it. Oh, yeah, end of suffering, yeah, suffering, end of suffering, yeah, you got it, right? And as we get more and more kind of exposure to the Dharma, the risk is more and more of the mind closing. Like, and we just hear things and we can't hear them new. We can't hear them with the beginner's mind, Suzuki Roshi said. So one of my teachers has said these teachings are not arranged horizontally, they're arranged vertically. And we drop more and more deeply into them. And in my mind, the probably most important insights related to freedom are deeper understanding of dukkha, anicca, anatta, the three characteristics of suffering, impermanence, and not self. And that this is the characteristic of phenomena. This is the characteristic of this dais and this room and all of you, all of them, all of me. And that freedom begins to open up as we see the poignancy of our situation as humans, the futility of finding perfect satisfaction amidst things, the changing nature of all, and this quality of selflessness, which is also means otherlessness. Not self also means not other. That there's no, everything we've taken ourselves to be, all the shit and all the good things, everything, everything, misses the mark. And that insight can really deepen to the point where there's an absolute conviction that we've lived our lives utterly intoxicated by an illusion. Utterly intoxicated by it and beholden to it, identified with what we thought we were. And the insights into this, dukkha, anicca, anatta, I think, in my mind, is central. It's a great question. It's worthy of probably a whole evening talking about the ways in which we learn. And some of these insights, as you said, are just can't really express easily. Some of them we could express. Some are little and some are big, you know. And my suggestion for us is that we see how our insight is being lived. That it's actually, we need to be living from our understanding. And if we're not, it may be we need to do more investigation. Yeah. That this practice should follow us out the door, off the cushion and out the door. And if we find, and it's very instructive to see where the slippage points are in our life, where we keep coming up against the same things, because those are the places where our insights haven't taken root. Yeah. Where what we understand in this moment hasn't carried over fully. And it's not a cause for despair or self-harshness, but actually it's like, oh, okay, my Dharma practice has been confined in a certain way, only to certain parts of my life. But the nature of the Dharma is like a wildfire. It wants to push into every corner of your life. It wants to do that. And we can relax more and more so that more and more of our life is taken over by these insights. Does it make sense, folks? Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's late. Do you want to keep talking, or should I talk? Talk? Anger, that's right. I forgot to say anger. Anger?
Anger.
Okay. So I do want to talk about anger, but before I get into it, just want to acknowledge that Buddhism, if we don't hear it with the right ear, if we don't catch the tone of it, it's super depressing. It really is. And I would say the same about me. If you don't hear me with somebody's clapping, that's, I don't know if that's a good sign. If you don't hear these words with the right ear, it's totally depressing. It is. And one of the ways in which we need to hear all of this, and one of the reasons why I think I stayed with the practice, is that even amidst the investigations of, you know, my greed and hatred and confusion, right, the parts of my life where there's deep shame, that amidst all of this, I think I was buoyed by the sense that there was something innocent about me. And I was alluding to that in the meditation instructions. that there's something deeply innocent about us. And having some connection or sense of this innocence allows us to venture in more deeply to things like anger, right? But if we take it very personally, and if we feel like who we are is at stake in our investigation, we can't fully look. We just won't open our eyes fully. And so the encouragement is to really listen to how you're listening. You know? Like, sometimes I think we can hear Dharma talks, and at least this is my mind, we can hear Dharma talks and it's like getting a report card in fifth grade. You know what I mean? Like, you hear something and then you kind of judge yourself and like give yourself a grade, you know, like, oh yeah, I know that, or I'm doing that, or I know, you know, and we actually take it all really personally. And so the encouragement is, in talking especially about these kinds of subjects, to be real light with yourself, yeah? And not to take this so personally. And know that nothing I'm saying is actually about who you are. That with anger, it is our urgent responsibility to care for it, because if we don't, others suffer. It's our urgent responsibility, but it's not who we are. And so, don't hear what I'm saying and make some conclusion about, I'm an angry person, or I'm not an angry person. Right? We're learning to notice anger without fixating it into a story of who we are. Does this make sense? We're learning to see the experience of anger moment by moment without adding the storyline of, I'm an angry person, I have an anger problem, right? So this is an urgent subject, I think, that to some extent the capacity for anger to overtake us is with all of us. And it is our responsibility to deal with it skillfully and to begin to move against the tendency of anger to always be focused on the external situation. That's the nature of anger, is to pull the attention to the external conditions and totally ignore that the seeds of anger are within. Right? Now, even if there's a genuine reason to get angry, it's more helpful to see the way in which the seeds within us are being stimulated than focus on the external situation. And I kind of do a little thought experiment when I get angry, which is I put the Dalai Lama right next to me, and I just ask myself, would he be angry right now? And the answer is that he would always have that big, sweet, goofy smile on his face, right? Even though we would be encountering the same situation, I know he would be cool. And what this leads me to is that it's not by definition the situation out there, but I'm involved with it. My way of seeing this moment is part of what's happening. And if I could see differently, the anger would be different. Now, this is not to make us wrong in any way for that anger arises. That anger arises in the same way that sound arises, right? You wouldn't try to stop hearing the bell. But we do try to stop feeling anger, right? Make ourselves wrong that it's arisen. And establish a whole story about what it means about us, that it has arisen. And this is not the point of this. That it's actually a deeper befriending of anger and allowing of its energy rather than a kind of shaming ourselves into feeling a different way. So, Shantideva, again, sort of Tibetan 8th century meditation master, says, and he uses very dramatic language, in part because the stake is so high. The stake, what's at stake in our anger, from the interpersonal to the international, is extremely high. It's not a small force, and it's killed millions. He writes, good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity or offerings to the blissful ones, a single flash of anger shatters them. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience, in all ways, urgently, and with zeal. Now, maybe it sounds a little dramatic, but part of becoming deeply trustworthy to other beings is their sense that you will not harm them, right? That for another person, wife or a husband or partner or friend or parent or child, to feel deeply at ease in our presence, something within them needs to trust that we are not going to hurt them. But even if we're really a good person, right, who doesn't want to cause harm, if our buttons get pushed in just the wrong ways, anger can arise and become destructive, right? And when that happens, it erodes the sense of safety that that person has, right? It just means that they can't fully relax anymore. And so Shantideva here is encouraging us to practice with urgency, with zeal, because the consequences are so profound. Now, I'm talking about at the subtle level, but hatred can accumulate and just people can just marinate in it. And they keep telling the same stories and the same stories, and that triggers the body, which is on fire, and more stories until we can get to the point where we're willing to hurt people. So this is one incident, but there are many examples like this. In the Rwandan genocide, over the course of approximately 100 days, at least 500,000 people were killed, with most estimates indicating up to 1 million, about 20% of the total population. In 1998, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda reported that sexual assault formed an integral part of the process of destroying the Tutsi ethnic group, and that rape was systematic and had been perpetrated against Tutsi women only. Evidence suggests that military leaders encouraged or ordered their men to rape Tutsi people, as well as condoning the acts taking place, without making efforts to stop them. Now, I'm not saying that hatred was the only thing involved in that genocide, that there are other economic forces at play, but it did require hatred for that to happen. And we can look around the globe now and through history and see that hatred was an element in the worst moments of humanity. Right? So who's going to do this work of diffusing this bomb? You know? Like, who's going to do this work? Somebody has to take a firm stand against hatred. But we can't do it in an intellectual way. We can't say, I don't want to hate. We actually have to move deeply inwards and befriend all that is hateful within us. We have to know our capacity for cruelty in a deep way. And meditation, Vipassana practice, is a lot like digesting the pool of pain. And the support of meditation techniques, of a community that is dedicated towards safety, dedicated towards non-harming, is very powerful. So, just have a couple minutes, and I haven't even started the talk on anger. It's unfortunate timing. It was my fault. But I'll say say just a few very kind of sketch a couple ways of working with this, okay? Watch the echoing between mind and body. Anger builds in a kind of, like, towards a kind of crescendo when thoughts and emotion kind of are reinforcing one another. So there's a story in the mind that justifies our anger, and then there's the body that is profoundly uncomfortable. And the sensations make a promise to us. They make this promise. If you act out, strike out in one way or another, verbally or physically, if you act out, I will leave you alone. That's sort of what our emotions are telling us. And the truth is that they're telling us that because it's partially true. That acting out is a momentary release. But the Buddha says that anger, with its poisoned tip and honeyed root, or reverse, honeyed tip, poisoned root, right? And we all know how delicious the fantasy of striking out is, right? Honey, just like it, right? And then we know the poisoned root too. Like, how many people can look back on their lives and say, like, oh yeah, it was really good I got angry there. Like, it's really, like, if I hadn't indulged in those fantasies of hatred, like, I just don't know where I would be. You know? Honey tip, poison root. Pay attention to the body. Bring a kind of equanimity to the body. Thich Nhat Hanh says, we care for our anger as a compassionate mother cares for her child who's having a tantrum. That this is the energy of mindfulness. And so we steep ourselves in patience and tolerance, right? And just stay and stay and let the anger devour you. It will feel like it will eat you alive. If you really let it do its thing, it will feel like it will eat you alive, and you just let it. The heart can hold that too. The last thing I'll say is that you can begin to develop some trust that if you're angry, delusion is present. Now, anger insists that it knows what's up. Right? I mean, part of anger is certainty, right? I mean, how many people get angry and they're like, yeah, I kind of think he's an asshole. It's like, no, it's like, he's an asshole. He might be an asshole. He might, you know, might be. Maybe. Not sure. It's like, anger is like, this is how it is, right? So certain of itself. And we need to look more deeply, and invariably, if we can look more deeply into the situation, through our stories, look more deeply, we will become less angry and more compassionate. That's just the nature of investigation. we look more deeply, we will arrive with a more compassionate heart. So look, really consider what's happening beyond all of our stories, or the superficial stories, what's really happening, what really led to their behavior, what's really leading to my reaction. And a lot to be learned from anger. I was an angry kid. Okay? This talk was 3 pages and I'm on the first paragraph.
Did you email it? True story.
What's that? Yeah. Okay. So thank you for your attention. It's been nice to be with you. I appreciate your practice. I don't say that casually. Like, I really do. I'm very happy that you're practicing. And as we practice more and more, the delight of Dharma is in seeing people practice. And so I do appreciate it.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.